SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Wednesday. Race fans, Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964, if you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website as well. SteveBick.com, and of course, minutes after we got off the air. Why does it always happen that way? Not always, but frequently. The word came, Jay Pribman, coming with the news that Country House would not be able to participate in the Preakness. And we now are moving well down the depth chart of the Derby for Preakness starters. Improbable will be the highest finish out of the Derby to compete at Pimlico. And Bill Mott on Tuesday said that Country House, you know, starting to cough and exhibit the kind of signs of, you know, being sick, and expecting that it's basic viral type, and as a result, he'll need, you know, some medication, some antibiotics, and that'll do it for his Preakness chances. So what has already been a tumultuous and confusing and I think I'm going to go back to arduous postscript to the Derby continues. And It doesn't ruin Preakness at all. I know people, you know, are trying to say that this now it's inconsequential and it's just, oh, it's a grade two and we'll see. Given a couple of other defections, Code of Honor had considered, and we mentioned yesterday that Shug had kind of pushed back the calendar with what he wants to do with Code of Honor, and the Dwyer now his target into early summer, and his absence, obviously, and Country House, and even Maximum Security, who's moved on to Monmouth. You know, yesterday, as it happens, the traditional seasonal press conference at Oceanport, and the first across the wire and disqualified Maximum Security will take up residence and start to work toward a Haskell start, and we'll see what else they consider between now and Haskell. And Haskell this year, July 20th, moved up a week and being run on a Saturday. And so we'll go down there probably Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, leading into Haskell, and actually a chance to see a Haskell again for a change. There's been the last several years with the Sunday, and when we'd go down to broadcast, really couldn't stay. You know, when Tina was working, particularly in the Mutual, you know, we could stay for a few days, but then, you know, there'd be a big Saturday at Saratoga, so we would head back. And as anybody who has gone to Haskell's historically, not an easy egress out of Oceanport to get back to the Garden State, back to the Parkway. You're lucky if an hour and a half. You think getting out of Derby stuff, getting out of Haskell, getting out of Monmouth, never easy. So we've basically done the broadcasting and then headed back home. And I'm excited that, you know, we can stay Saturday and enjoy the Haskell and then come back on Sunday. And in fact, then later that week, we've got the Captain Gala at Saratoga City Center. The second year we'll be hosting that, and looking forward to that too. So there's your top line news from overnight and from really the last 21 hours, and that Preakness Field with Improbable and War of Will headlining, obviously, and then the horses that have been waiting, Always Mining and Another Twist of Fate, as well as Signalman and Owendale, Bourbon War entering the fray, Mark Hennig, Mr. Money. We'll wait for Brett Calhoun, who of course we talked to on Monday morning, and we'll see about he and Chester Thomas, but I don't see why they would not take a chance. And Laughing Fox, of course, you heard from Steve Asmussen, who was just terrific. If you heard the replay this morning, how could you not smile listening? And you know, that's the Steve Asmussen that not everybody gets to see, but away from the usual glare, funny and sassy, and he was great yesterday. That was mighty entertaining. Bodie Express waiting for decision. And as I mentioned, I think you might have heard me mention yesterday, Michael Trombetta is monitoring Win-Win-Win at Fair Hill. And I think there's a chance that they participate, even though you're not seeing him on possible probable lists. Keep an eye on Trombetta. Meanwhile, the anguished situation involving Gary West continues to morph, and it is also now, as you heard if you were listening to the replay just now, leading into today's live show, you heard the frustration and touched with some anger and really disgust at War of Will being brought into the DQ conversation. And not only did you hear Mark's very emotional response, later in the day Gary Barber released a statement that was really polished and classy, and at the same time very forceful in refuting Gary West's suggestion that War of Will may have in fact himself fouled Maximum Security. And as we said yesterday in that conversation with John White, you certainly have to include War of Will's presence and running up on the heels and trying to get through that seam. I mean, that is part of what transpired, and you can't, you really can't separate that. But at the same time, Mark's point that there had been, before, and then I added, kind of a coda to Maximum Security later on up the stretch, which nobody has really discussed. If you watch the stretch run between the 8th and the 16th pole, he comes out and whether you want to call it hurting or just, kind of drifting into the path, Maximum Security does it there. So really there's a handful. There's a good three different moments where there's the race riding going on, and it really feels like the race riding and the positioning is a big part of how people are seeing this. And it's the really the reason why nobody's wrong. And nobody's wrong here. I know that there's a certain percentage of either DQ camp or no DQ camp that thinks the other's completely wrong. But it, as always, I mean, those of us that are around the game on a, you know, betting on a regular basis, we've all been taken down. And I'm going to guess, or put up, and I'm going to guess that there isn't anybody that hasn't been taken down on a much more questionable call. I guarantee you that. This is close. And I know, there's a certain side of this. Absolutely. No, not absolutely. It whether you call it, you want to call it 80-20, 60-40, 50-50, whatever. It's not open and shut in either direction. If he had been left up, it would have been debated endlessly, and being taken down, it's going to be debated endlessly, which is okay, because that's the equation we deal with every single day. You know, and I had an exchange with a longtime listener and you know, player and an owner in partnerships, Tony Infante from Tampa. And, you know, Tony says, oh, you can't objectively look at that and say, well, you can actually. And when it comes to objectivity versus subjectivity, everything we do in this game is subjective. Every decision you make, every handicapping decision, every wager you make, it's a game of accrued knowledge. So if somebody's saying to you, oh, you're not being objective, no, you don't have to be. Don't feel like you have to be, because you're basing your view of this on your collective understanding of the game. So the one part of this that makes me smile is that, you know, the non-racing and wagering public, they're like captivated by they're like, what exactly happened, and why is that? It's pretty funny that people are engaged, and I know now people are saying, oh, well, nobody's going to care about the Preakness, and we're going to lose those people, the interest of those people. No, they'll tune in, and if they're interested now, we'll keep them interested. So your job out there is, when it comes to the water cooler conversations, keep the ball in the air. You know, tell everybody, oh, you got to tune in. You got to see what's going to happen next. What's going to happen next, right? That's the advertising for something or other. Anyway, I just will reiterate, and we'll let today's lineup, you know, deal with their view of it. And we'll do some of the contest part, the Kentucky Derby Betting Challenge. Pete Fornatel is going to join us, along with Derby Betting Challenge winner, in what you knew would have to be a great story, that whoever, you know, however the pendulum was going to swing, DQ, non-DQ, you know, somebody probably was going to be impacted, and the decision was going to elevate a winner, and it did, and it's a great story. Rick Broth of Atlanta, originally from Cleveland, but Rick Broth is going to join us with Pete. So we'll have some fun here in the next 20 minutes or so. Nick Luck, who came over and was part of course, the NBC telecast, will get Nick's view of everything. He was right in the middle of it. There's a fabulous fisheye photo, if you haven't seen it, focusing on a just... you can tell Luis Saez that is, you know, dealing with everything as it's coming down. And Dave Greinig is to his left, and Nick Luck to his right. A very cool picture. I was talking to Dave Greinich yesterday. And Nick, I'm sure, has got, you know, a interesting take on everything that transpired. So we'll get Nick Luck's view of it, and we'll also let Nick opine on the retirement announcement of Pat Smulin, an absolute all-time great, and his retirement, which he announced. So, Nick Luck, Sid Fernando, of course, Sire Watch, Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale, the top of hour two. We'll talk to Sid. And, you know, one thing that I noticed this morning, I'm not even sure how I, what came to mind, but, you know, with the Derby win for Country House, who's a son of Looking at Lucky, Accelerate also a Looking at Lucky. So the Breeders' Cup Classic winner and now a Derby winner for Looking at Lucky. We'll talk to Sid, get his take. After Sid, Tim Layden. And I joked with Tim. I said, are you ready for your happy recap? Our happy recap comes midweek after Derby. So Tim Layden from Sports Illustrated. We'll get Tim's take. And in hour three, Jeremy Plonk and Seth Merrow, and expecting Bob Baffert to want to talk about McKinsey and get his recap as well from Derby with his 5th, 6th, and 16th when it came to Roadster. So another busy morning. We're going to start it off, and we'll start with Rick Broth because we've got Rick on the line, and then we'll feather Pete in. But Rick has been a big player and fan of the game, and has owned some horses as well, and has one of the fun post Derby stories about getting in the car dejectedly to head home, and then, wait a minute, turn that car around. Rick Broth, good morning, congratulations.
Hey, thanks, man. It's pretty funny because I listened to your show, and I was working in Nashville on the way up, and I listened to your show the whole way, and I heard Pete, you know, on your show, and then Gary from Churchill, who was supposed to call me so I could give him my credit card. And he hadn't called me back, and he was on your show. I was like, get off the radio and call me, man.
I love it.
Yeah, it was an interesting week, to say the least.
Before we talk about the specifics and some of the wild swings of emotion involved, not to mention fortunes, your background and your tie-in, because I know you've won some big contests before, and you've obviously been close to the game.
Yeah, I have to say, my story was pretty much I'm a middle manager. I'm not one of the trust fund babies like all these guys in these tournaments that I'm in with. And, you know, it's like playing poker when you're sitting down at a table and you've got $100 and the other guys have $1,000. You know, it's sort of a disadvantage. But I have to say, I am somewhat self-made in the racing industry because long story short, I hit the pick four. I was a very small bettor, and I'd go, bet $200-$300, and I hit the pick four when Drosselmeyer won the Belmont.
Ooh!
And I was sitting at home with my illegal account in Atlanta, Georgia, and I literally had $1.80 left in my account, and I couldn't. And I told everybody Drosselmeyer's going to win the Belmont, and I couldn't even bet $2 on the race, and then Drosselmeyer won. And I was running through the house, and my account went from $1.80 to $101,000. So that was and then I got into buying a few horses, and I owned Lady of Shamrock. Do you remember Lady of Shamrock?
Sure, of course.
Yeah, and and a couple others, and we paid $11,000 for Lady of Shamrock, and I had a filly Guadalupe High that we paid $10,000 for with Ronnie Werner, and I had a really incredible run for, like I said, for the kind of money that we went in for. And it had an incredible run. So now, again, I usually lose most of it back in the stock market somehow. But, you know, the stock market's at an all-time high, and somehow I still have all these red arrows on it. But anyway.
I love it. I love it. You know, Lady Shamrock came up. She came up with John Sadler and with Costa at the time of the you know, the horse of the year voting and in talking about the, you know, the ascendancy and the involvement of Costa in the game, and their purchase. I don't remember, you know, the ins and outs, but when did they buy Shamrock?
We bought her for $11,000. She broke her maiden at Churchill, and my trainer was, I was partners with Ronnie Werner, and Ronnie's a great horseman. He's a super horseman, and he knows his stuff, and he physically, you know, he's one of those guys, he'd say, Rick, he's an athlete, you know, she's an athlete, we're going to get this one, you know, he's a great horseman. But, we got an offer for $175,000, and I will say I love Ronnie to death, but I said, absolutely not. We are not selling this horse. And there was another partner involved, and I got voted off the island, and she ended up, you know, winning the going to the Breeders' Cup twice, making $1 million on the track, and sold to the Japanese for $2 million.
Right.
So it could have been an unbelievable story. And the other thing that was funny about that is, you know, the TVG coverage, you know how TVG is. It's like West Coast bias. And, I mean, it was torture. I mean, they would interview the groom, you know, the owners. The groom, I mean, you know, walking over. Mike Smith said she's baby Zenyatta. It was a rough, you know. So, you know, at the time, if you own horses, you're running at fairgrounds or Churchill. It's like, okay, they're in the gate. Oh, they're off. Oh, he won. All right, let's talk about. They're walking up at Santa Anita. You know, so.
Well, she was an important horse in the origin story for Costa Aronis and Sadler.
Right.
She was one of their first big Grade One winners. The American Oaks.
I'm good at getting other people started usually. So.
Well, you've won a Grade One gamble at Keeneland as well, and I think Pete Fornatel is on the line now finally with us too. Pete, good morning.
Hey, Pete.
Huh? Good morning to you guys. Yes,
there he
is. Got the mute. Kinchin does that to me all the time. Stuck on the mute button, talking for 10 seconds, and then realizing he's not actually on the air. How are you guys today?
Well,
you know, that's
we're good.
Funny. I saw Kinchin at the Derby right before the race, and gave him he gave me a fist bump, and it's like that guy's golden, because it definitely changed my life.
I usually say the opposite about JK, but that's good that somebody's had the Midas experience from the man's
staff. Definitely gave me I credit the bump to him for sure.
Well,
the funny thing, I said when Pete Fortnoe calls, when he called me yesterday, I said he's the opposite of the Grim Reaper. You get certain phone calls and you're like, oh boy, I don't want to pick this one up. But when Pete calls, it's like, wow, it's like Santa Claus calling, you know.
You know you did something good. That's what the trainers say when we get them on Monday. Rick, the thing that's amazing about your Kentucky Derby challenge equation, you were 0 for the challenge heading into the Derby. Talk about the weekend.
Yeah, I had a rough 2 days. I will say the funniest thing of all of this is that literally a week before, my son, I have a friend, you know, the ATM, Anthony Matera, we're buddies, we talk about horses all the time, and my sons have been around us, and they're like, you two guys need to do a podcast. And I said, what the heck is a podcast? Anyway, so last week I went out and bought a microphone, and we did a Derby podcast 3 days before the Derby. And I will say, you know, we called it Let It Ride. I mean, as amateur as you could be, we didn't practice, we didn't do anything, we just did it. But I will say, and I hate to brag, but with one of the, I literally on the podcast, I picked, you know, if you listen to the podcast now, you're like, you know, he calls me Notre Dame, but I ran 1, 2, 3. I'm in the Derby. Those were my picks, literally. And I pretty much dissed every other horse. So, and obviously, you know, the luckiest takedown I've ever had. But but the podcast thing, it's just so surreal to have people like, I mean, Keith Jones, the hockey guy, emailed me, Rick, listen to the podcast, hit for 22,000. My wife's friends, they're flight attendants, you know, never been to a racetrack before. You know, they listen to the podcast and they're emailing my wife that, oh my God, you know, we went to such and such track and spent $12 and hit the exacta for $3,000. I mean, stuff like that. And that's been just unbelievable. So
well, you had,
you know, for the Preakness, we're gonna there's a lot of pressure on us.
I can't wait to hear the podcast. I think Rick's gonna put you and me out of a job, giving out these three-time trifectas on his show. I don't know.
No, believe me, there's way too much cussing and too much amateurism for the two of them, for me and the ATM. Believe me, you guys are the pros.
The first 2 days leading up to the big race, I know you said you didn't hit anything, but as horse players, we all know there's different kinds of didn't hit everything days. There's days where we just are wrong, and there's days where we're seeing the ball well, but we're getting split in our exactas, and we're getting bad trips with the best horse. Which kind of bad 2 days, Rick, was it for you leading up to this year's Kentucky Derby?
Well, again, I'm not a chalk player. I'm always looking for bombs. And, you know, I had a pretty big bet on Neil Pessin's horse, Bell's the One. And, you know, and again, I don't turn it around. And I had my own personal bets where I would have hit the pick five. I had so many tickets that ended up with 8, 13, 20. And somehow I left out Bricks and Mortar. That's the kind of things I do to hit a pick. I'd never even look to see what the pick five paid because, you know, I don't even want to look.
As I told you on our show yesterday, Rick, when it comes to you complaining about missing out on the pick five after going up for that score, I'm going to have to break out the world's smallest violin, okay?
Oh, I agree. I know. Believe me. But I will say, like I said, I was on the wrong end of a lot of things. You know, I still remember the worst one ever was I was going to hit the pick six when Powers Court won the Arlington Million. And then DeSormo stood up and waved his magical wand, and then they took him down. And I just, that one still hurts. You know, and then Elate not being put up, coming through the rail, and Mike Smith. I love Mike Smith, but he definitely cut the horse off. Bayern was a little questionable. I've been on the wrong end of almost every, whenever it's blinking, it's never gone my way. So,
what you're saying is this isn't a habit. This isn't something you do on the regular, getting put up and winning.
No, that's what I'm
like
saying.
This.
Never.
An extraordinary
I'm open life
event.
As far as put up. So, but all my track friends are all saying you can never whine again, and you know, which is true.
You've got to tell the At the Races listeners and Steve the story of how you found out. What? Talk us through the moments after they hit the wire in the Derby until where you found out what was going on.
Yeah, that's a funny story. I mean, literally, you know, we're going to drive to Nashville, and I wanted to beat the traffic. And my wife, we get in the car, we get in the car, and, you know, she looks at me, and the whole talk between Churchill and I-65 is how I'm in the barn, I'm going to take a long break, I got to take a break, I suck, and what a loser I am. And, you know,
you had no idea what was going on back at the track.
That's
just,
what was going on.
You saw them hit the wire, saw that you didn't win, and were out of there.
Yeah. And then Anthony Matera calls, and he actually had a bet. Somehow he hedged the other way. He had a big bet. He got taken down, but he called me, and he goes, you know there's an objection. And I'm like, what? And the next 16 and a half minutes pulling over on I-65 was the longest 16 minutes. You know, it was unbelievable. I'm like, and then he was upset because he had it the other way, so he pretty much hung up on me. And then I'm calling my sons that are, you know, my son's down in Florida. He's trying to watch it on TV, and he's saying, no, they're not going to take, they said they're not going to take him down because it's the Derby. And I just couldn't get a straight answer from anybody, and it was 16 of the longest minutes, you know. her girlfriend texted from California, this is bullshit, you know, this is ridiculous. how can they change the outcome? And I'm like, shut up, you know. And then the funniest thing is then when I heard it, trying to get back into Churchill Downs. I mean, we parked at a house right by Churchill Downs and walked back, you know, trying to go the other way through traffic. And it was funny because we went through this, like, VIP area. And, I fist bumped Rand Paul, Baker Mayfield, and Chris Collinsworth.
That's funny.
Those three intention, you got all the celebs.
Right. Oh, and this is another great one. My son's college, I was so cold that I literally gave my last $2 to my son's buddy from UK. And so he could bet my three picks in the exacta. $6, I'm talking a dollar ticket. That's how bad the day was with my advice. And he watched the race with us and threw his ticket out.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so then we went back to Churchill, and he's making a claim, and hopefully they're going to. They said if he ripped it up, he'll get paid, but if he threw it on the floor, obviously, one of them stupers got it.
Stupers paradise.
Yeah.
Stupers paradise.
Well, there's a lesson.
I didn't even think about that.
There's a lesson there about do not, you know, make sure, hang on to them, and do not ever just tear them up and drop them. I mean, it's gotten easier to track tickets, but still,
right.
Don't just give it up. What were you playing exactly, and you know, dollars and cents? What was the box? What was the play?
I mean, I had a $20 exacta, $20 exacta, and I had a $1.50 try. So I mean, and what's so funny about it is I've been in these tournaments so many times that where, you know, I'm in the Breeders' Cup tournament or I'm in these high stakes tournaments, and if I have 40 grand going to the last race, you know, I'm betting 5,000 and going home with the 35. And so many of these other guys are all in, you know. I don't know, except either trust fund babies or a lot of them just have trash balls. And I'm somewhat of a coward, you know. So they always make fun of me because I'm never all in. And this time I had to go all in. That was all I had left.
Amazing.
One of the many things I find so interesting about your story, Rick, is how proudly and relentlessly old school you are. Does it give you satisfaction when you look at your competitors in this tournament who have enough computing power to launch a rocket into the moon, some of them, and there you are with a pen and a copy of the Daily Racing Board? Does that give you satisfaction?
Well, like we talked about, I'm so old school. My kids call me the Rockhead. Like I said, you don't know how funny it is, the thought of me doing a podcast. I mean, I still can't figure out how to get onto the Zencaster thing. I mean, they're just like, I get called the Rockhead so many times a day, it's unreal. But, and I am a Rockhead, but, you know. I am an old school handicapper. You know, we've heard this, we've talked about this forever, that I would love, you know, I want to be buried with the old-fashioned racing form. I mean, the thought of holding a big racing form that they used to sell, if they still have at Woodbine, is, that's, to me, that's the ultimate. I love, you know, reading the racing form is like reading, you know, Playboy.
Rick, on that front, how many of these are you playing in, over the course of a year? I mean, the live money, the things like the betting challenges, and of course, Breeders' Cup betting challenge. How much NHC competition? What's your typical calendar on the contest?
Oh, I mean, I always target the BCBC. That's just, you know, I love that tournament. And I've backed into the NHC. The NHC is just, a lot of the tournaments have gotten pretty tough nowadays. There's a lot of guys, again, two and three entries every weekend. And, you know, the other thing is a lot of the races, you know, the horse tourneys and a lot, they don't have Churchill. All the tracks are always fighting, you know, so we don't ever get to see the good races. And it's become a lot of those tournaments, you know, comes down to a $6,000 claimer at Gulfstream or Laurel or something, you know, a race that I don't even want to watch, let alone bet. And so it's gotten a lot tougher. But, I was telling Pete, I'm good on the big days. I've had, you know, probably five scores now, and they've all been on either Derby, Belmont, or Breeders' Cup. You know,
interesting.
I'm good. You know, a Thursday afternoon at
Oh, you go ahead, finish your thought, and then I have a turn.
No, I'm just saying, a Thursday afternoon or a $6,000 claimer, I'm 0 for life. I mean, you could give me free bets all day. And I'm like, there's no way.
So my hard sell to you, Rick, is you got to come up for the Woodbine Mile Day tournament in September in Toronto. You got three stakes races at least on that card. So you got the stakes races that you like, and you'll get to hold that oversized old school racing form, and we know that gets you excited. So I would be
there for sure. So I mean, you know, the other thing, it used to be like back in the day, we'd go to Florida, and I was always known. My brother used to always make fun of me. Oh, you don't show up until the sixth race. Because it used to be the last four or five races a day were the, you know, allowance and stakes races and turf races.
Yeah.
And now that's the new thing. On the tracks, they throw in a $6,000 claimer with, you know, in the eighth race now or ninth race. So I'd be like that personally. I hate that. So,
Rick, expand before we let you go. Expand on your, you know, on your handicapping method and what you... You know, what you like to focus in on, big day or no big day, and, you know, any other tools besides straight PPs?
Well, you know, I have several theories, you know, that I have, like, my own system and everything. But the one thing that I was telling Pete, the one thing that really irks me is in the new racing form, they don't show the weights of the other horses. And I think so many people forget about weights. Like, you know, TV, nobody mentions weight, but weight is important. I mean, you try running around, put 8-pound ankle weights and go run a mile. I mean, it makes a difference. It's an equalizer. And, you know, they don't even, when you look at the racing form now, at the end of the form, they don't even show the weights of the other horses. So in other
in
words,
the
run, race
in the running
you,
lines, you mean, yeah.
Huh?
In the running right. lines. So the horses in that race will have it, but then when you go back and look through the PP, you like to see, okay, last time he was giving 6 pounds, this time he's getting 2 or whatever, that kind of old school slash very European way of looking at
Well, that's one of the factors, but I'm just saying that's something, again, the racing form gives me, you know, buyer numbers. I don't care about buyer numbers. It gives me things I don't want, you know. And the other thing that I'm a big fan is I like to eyeball horses, too. I love, you know, if a horse is washed out, sweating. I mean, if I'm between two horses, one of them's washed out and the other one looks perfectly clean, as a general rule, I'd rather have the horse not sweating.
I got a specific question, actually, Rick, on Twitter. Diane's asking what it was about Country House that, who I think most of us had certainly considered him as a late run, you know, bottom of the try and super type of a horse, you know, kind of the, you know, the big price clunk up, and he never should have been. I mean, the fact that he was 65-1 and overnight on Friday night he was 70-1 was very strange compared to, you know, some of the other horses that figured to be longer prices. But what was it about Country House that you felt strong enough that he needed to be used in the top slot as well?
I mean, I'm a big Bill Mott fan, number one. You know, and I was on the podcast. I talked about I think they can run 1-2, and I love Code of Honor. So, but I mean, I thought that the second race at Fairgrounds, the horse showed that move. You know, that move that just visually caught my eye. And I said, you know, if you look back, every time he ran, horse couldn't get out of the gate. Bill Mott, let's see, who's the best trainer that could possibly improve that? Maybe Bill Mott could get him to break better. You know, so I thought if he breaks in the middle like he did, why can't he win it? You look like an improving horse to me. And the only one I was obviously dead wrong about was National Security. And, you know, the horse ran a great race, but... I was listening to your show on the way up, and a lot of people were, you know, saying they were sick of hearing about the $16,000 claim thing. But, again, I think that's very important. You know, I mean, to me, like I said, if we, the three of us were partners on it, and our trainer said, boy, this horse is a freak, he could win the Derby, are we going to put him in a $16,000 claiming race? This is something a little, I don't know, something fishy about that horse to me.
Well, that part of it's been explained, including Ben Glass on the show with us after the Florida Derby, and I suppose that they, if they could get New Year's Day back from South America, and the dam that they sold for $11,000, they with a full brother in the belly, maybe they were basically a wholesale they were getting rid of that that end. I mean, of all the horses that the Wests are involved in, and you know, it wasn't until afterward that everything sort of came together.
So you think the horse just improved that? They didn't think he was that good, and then they were like, "Well, yeah, wow, I guess he is."
Well, I can tell you that Jason Service didn't want to go for 16. He thought that they could have dropped him in for a higher tag, but they had. Back in December and in the late fall, they had liquidated the dam, and the siblings, none of the siblings could run, and they sold. They couldn't keep New Year's Day even in North America. They couldn't even keep him. Nobody wanted him in Oklahoma or Louisiana or any other regional program. And he ends up in South America. I mean, they were. It was a fire sale essentially.
Okay.
That's all.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I wish somebody could explain to me, I would love your thoughts, Steve, is on the so-called 40% trainers nowadays. You know, the Jorge Navarro Service. You know, sometimes Mike Makers, like, to me, is like, he's either the great, some of these guys defy the form to me. I don't know how some of these guys improve these horses and bat at 40% now. It's just a little strange to me, but.
Well, a lot of it, the speculation that everybody, not everybody, but plenty of people want to make is obviously, kind of lurks over it. Then you've also got guys that are running where they're going to win, period. And they don't enter horses anymore if they're not in a position to win. And that's one of the biggest changes that's gone on. That the when it comes to win percentage, which nobody used to care about. I mean, the win percentage wasn't publicized. It wasn't a decisive factor in anything. But now, prospective owners won't look at trainers if they're. I mean, 15%, which used to be the standard, the best trainers in history, if they could win at 15%, that was a good number. And now it's like. You gloss over that. It's unbelievable. But
I agree.
People are running. One of the other things, everybody talks about the situation about the number of starts. I know people want to blame it on Lasix. They want to blame it on the decreased stamina, the decreased ability of horses to run back. How about the circumstances that we deal with now, guys don't want to run if they aren't in a position to win. So that's a big part of it. They're not starting horses anymore unless they can win. So part of that contributes anyway. I've got Nick Luck that I've got to bring in, and Rick, I couldn't be happier for you. It's a fun story, and as we always say, when there's a disqualification, some people say, we got stiffed, and we money out of our pocket, but somebody always gets paid on the other end. I mean,
well,
I think people forget that, right?
The only thing I'll say is, like I said, just all I can say about that is that just imagine, God forbid, if War of Will would have gone down. That would have been an ugly scene. It could have been the end of racing, in my opinion. So I mean,
we keep hearing that. At the same time, the Philly clipped heels on Friday, Positive Spirit, and she's like an afterthought. Nobody has said two words about.
To be fair, they're going slower at that part of the race. Would be my only.
But what I'm saying at that point in the race. If we would have had an accident, it would have been gruesome.
No, it's bad, and it's problematic anywhere. It's going to happen. Rick, it's really fun, and I know that you've gotten a lot of appropriate attention and people entertained by. By the story. So continued success, and we'll see you. Where do you come? You said Preakness. What you're going to see you down the road?
We'll see. I mean, like I said, just for the record, I do love your show, and I'm always listening. I enjoy it, Again, I like people to keep it pithy. That's what I try to do when on our podcast. I said, to me, my son's like, oh, a podcast should be 15, 20 minutes. And I'm like, who the hell wants to listen to me for 15, 20 minutes? Because I need to make it 10, 8 minutes. I mean, you keep it pithy, you know.
Well, thanks so much, Rick. I appreciate it. And Pete, I've got to get Nick Luck. Nick's got some timing here, so let me.
We'll recap another time later.
You got it. I appreciate
later,
it, guys. Rick Broth, everybody, and Pete Fornital on the Kentucky Derby betting challenge. We'll stay right here. Nick Luck was standing by, and he joins us now. And of course, Nick on hand for the NBC telecast. Nick, good morning.
Thanks, Steve. How are you?
Excellent. And Nick, there's a phenomenal picture that appeared all over the place with you and Dave Greinig abreast of Luis Saez, and you can tell that, you know, that you know the tension that everybody is feeling as they waited for a decision from the stewards. Just a remarkable scene, and I'm wondering if you can compare it to anything in your broadcasting career.
No, is the short answer. I can't. It was extraordinary drama the way it played out. There was such a degree of uncertainty as to exactly what had happened and who claimed foul on whom and when and what the sequence of events was. And I think, you know, even 3 days later, people are still trying to deduce exactly what happened and when it happened. But we all know what the result was. But no, in terms of the way a major sporting event played out like that, I can't think of any precedent. I remember a dramatic a turnaround of a classic horse race in Britain. The Ledger got turned around a few years ago, and I remember for that. And that was full of high drama and some, you know, very evocative shots, but yeah, nothing on the scale of the Kentucky Derby. And pretty remarkable, really. And it's been very interesting now, having come home, to see how it's unraveled as the days have gone on, and witnessed some of the mudslinging and some of the sort of general unpleasantness that surrounded it, and wondered what impact that's going to have over the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Going much further beyond that too. There's mm-hmm. obvious ramifications of how this race will be ridden going forward, and you know, how it had, you know, for many years. I don't want to say anything goes, but it was pretty close to that. Your view, Nick, as the day unfolded, you know, it's not. I guess it's not too different from the Breeders' Cup coverage that you're involved in, you know, with some celebratory moments and conversations. But there was also the specter of the weather, and the kind of knowing that we very well could get yet another wet derby. Talk about the day and things leading up to, you know, putting him in the gate.
Well, from a broadcast point of view, you mean?
Yeah, and just from, you know, your impressions and how the day was unfolding and you know, what we were heading toward,
I thought the day had unfolded quite smoothly in the circumstances, Steve. Insofar as I think on Wednesday, Thursday, some of the forecasts were predicting, you know, 32, 35 mils of rain on Friday and 40 mils of rain on Saturday, and the whole weekend would be a complete washout, and no one quite knew what was going to happen. Up until about, you know, 10 to 6 on Saturday evening, everything seemed to be going quite smoothly. I thought we'd had some good results. Obviously, we had the incident at the beginning of the Kentucky Oaks, which was unfortunate, but fortunately, horse and rider remained unscathed. But apart from that, everything seemed to have gone well. I thought the supporting card threw up some very decent performances on both days, and so I'm not saying we were sleepwalking towards the finish, but obviously we then had that very intense, very heavy rain just before the big race, and that did just sort of seem to change the atmosphere and change the environment slightly. But you know, who knows whether that actually had any impact on what happened in the race. I would doubt it myself, but I suppose it all added to the drama, really.
Well, the one thing it did impact certainly was the quality and consistency of the surface, because the track being opened up, the harrowing of the track, and I'm not sure I forgot to DVR the broadcast, but I understand that maybe Kenny Rice saw Todd Pletcher walk out into the track during the walkover and asked him.
Yeah, that's right. It was Eddie Olczyk, actually.
Eddie, okay.
Doing the walkover with Todd and saw him walk down to the inside, and he, Todd appeared somewhat perplexed that the track had been harrowed. Having the track, we sealed, I'm pretty sure, about an hour before that, and then they re-harrowed it after they sealed it, which was to the bemusement of quite a few people, really, particularly given the fact that it was at that point when they harrowed that the rain really started to intensify. So it did. It certainly made it probably an unusual surface, and that will have had an impact on the way the race panned out. What I meant was, I'm not sure that the surface and the conditions necessarily had an impact on what Maximum Security did turning for home, which of course is what everyone's going to talk about time immemorial. It was a strange one. Did he see the person standing on the inside fence? It's interesting that he changed onto the lead. You wanted him to change halfway around the bend, which is a very, very unusual thing to see.
Tracking the race around and leading up to that point, what did you expect? Because we didn't talk leading into Saturday, so I don't know, you know, what where your lean was and who you had favored, and of course, you know, we lose a favorite, you know, a couple of 72 hours out, we lose the race favorite. What was your expectation of how the race was going to unfold going in, and then as you watched it, take it from there?
I thought Maximum Security would either win or finish last. I don't think I'm alone in that. It's a question of whether you believe the numbers he was bringing up from Florida, and that was then somewhat sort of tempered by, if you did believe those, whether you believed that a horse who started life in a 16 claimer could come out and win the Kentucky Derby even for a trainer who's clipping at a high percent. But the answer was evidently going to be very likely from early, and then it's amazing the way he rallied. It was a tremendous performance, notwithstanding any of the drama. So did I expect him to win going into the race? On balance, no, not really. Was it a performance I was incredibly impressed with? Yes. Who did I expect to come out best? I thought, in the absence of Omaha Beach, I thought Tacitus would win. He ran a fine race. He'll probably win the Belmont, won't he? Or go pretty close. The one thing I hope is that we're assuming now that Maximum Security is not going to run in the Preakness. They said he's not going to run in the Preakness. I hope he bowls out again and runs in the Belmont. But I suspect that's unlikely if they want to take themselves out of the Triple Crown altogether. It's a shame. It's such a shame. I mean, the one redemptive factor to Saturday would have been if the winner, or the first past the post and the promoted winner, would have been able to meet each other again in 2 weeks' time, and everyone could have been grown up about it. But sadly, there's too much at stake for that.
From what you saw live and then what you saw during the subsequent steward evaluation, talk about those 20 minutes.
Well, as I said, there was a degree of confusion, because I don't know if you've seen the little clip there is of the official passing the slip of paper to Travis Stone, which got the numbers the wrong way around and told him that seven, the winner had objected to the 20, and Travis obviously realized that was not so, you know, he intuited that 20 had objected to the seven. It's not the greatest start in the world. And of course, what he hadn't been told and what we weren't told and what everybody else didn't know was that John Court had objected as well. So it was very difficult to get to establish the full picture. And having not known that John Court had objected and then been told that, you wondered whether Gaffleon had objected. And you didn't know that he hadn't objected because Mark Cassie had told him not to object until further down the track. So all the little constituent parts of this objection were somewhat confusing. Add to that, and this has been pointed out elsewhere, that of course no inquiry was called, and there was no obvious indication that the stewards were looking into this incident until the objection and the claim of foul went up on the board or was announced over the tannoy. So that also added to the confusion. Well, hang on a minute, why wasn't there an inquiry called immediately? Which I guess is one of the questions that the stewards would have been asked had they chosen to answer questions after the press conference. So there were a number of confusing elements to the way it played out, which I guess is why it ended up taking quite a long time to resolve and to unravel. Listen, do I think that the stewards got it right? Under the under the terms of the way that the rules are set out in Kentucky, I think it's quite hard to criticize the result that they came to. But there were certainly some issues with the way they showed their working, and there are certainly issues with the rules. I mean, that's the more fundamental point, isn't it? It's you know, I have no issue with the way the rules were executed, but you know, it's certainly prompted enough debate to think that it's time to have a review as to whether most states in the U.S. want to be Category 2 jurisdictions or whether they want to be Category 1 jurisdictions in terms of the way they use their disqualifications. There's a very good piece, if you haven't seen it, I'm sure you have. There's a very good piece written by Kim Kelly, the chief steward in Hong Kong, all about how the disqualification in the Japan Cup a few years ago, of a similar nature, essentially affected a change in the way that stewards' inquiries are conducted in Japan, and sort of brought them more in line with other countries around the world. And you wonder whether this will prompt the same effect in America that it did in Japan. I don't know whether it will or not, but I sort of think there's probably a significant body of opinion that thinks that if you can affect a scenario where the winner on the merit keeps the race, then that's probably something to be working towards. The danger of that, of course, is that then people think it's a free-for-all and that jockeys are going to ride rough and do whatever they like. But if you then add to that proper penalties for the riders, then you should be able to take that potential side effect away.
And that might get debated, but I think you hit it right on the head, that it opens a can of worms. You know, the idea that unless it's so egregious somehow that there has to be a disqualification. I don't see how there's actually much of a difference. Because people will still be arguing, you know, the nuances of any contact,
of any takedown. Yeah, and you do that. I've always maintained that we on balance in the UK maybe don't take enough horses down, and that, you know, they do need to tighten up on rough and dangerous riding. But I think on balance it's a system that works slightly better. And certainly in the last two or three years, there's been more of a willingness to certainly turn around the first two placings. It would be very unusual to see a horse disqualified and placed last here, or disqualified and placed 17th or whatever. But if there are two horses fighting out the finish, and the actions of one horse has significantly impacted on another, and that the stewards can be satisfied. I mean, you can never prove anything beyond reasonable doubt in a horse race, but the stewards are satisfied that the distance by which the afflicted party was beaten was, you know, less than the distance that it was cost by the interference, then you turn the result around, and I think that's perfectly fair enough.
With the disqualification, the subsequent, I won't call the celebration muted. I mean, it was a fairly typical Derby celebration. But what was your sense? And you've certainly been in Breeders' Cup opportunities. You've been around Belmont plenty. I one element of this is how just difficult and unfair this is, you know, to him. And you know, with all the pressure and all the attention about, you know, the opportunity to win a Derby, and you know, as I said yesterday, he's not retiring. He'll have other Derby starters, but it does feel like, you know, this is not the way that Bill Mott would have wanted to get a Derby.
No, that's true. Though having said that, I've seen situations in the past where there's been a long stewards inquiry and the connections of the runner-up have said, I don't want to get it like this. Now, he didn't say that. He said he felt that the horse should have been taken down. So, you know, he was happy enough for the horse to be taken down, irrespective of whether or not it gave him a bad feeling to win a Derby like that. And he knew his horse was not the deserving winner. But he felt by the letter of the law, the winner, the first past the post, should have gone down. He might have felt a little bit of awkwardness claiming the trophy, but clearly not too much, because he'd articulated quite clearly that he felt that the winner should have come down.
Well, a circumstance like really no other, obviously, in the race's history. There's been high profile inquiries and objections and DQs over the years, but this one. This is going to be the mother of all DQs.
Oh, unbelievable! I the one thing that slightly puzzles me, you just don't know who people talk to and how their mindset works and develops over the days after the fact. But Gary West went from being the most magnanimous and good loser in really difficult circumstances to sort of. To not being really in the space of 2 days, which I found quite a head scratcher in a sense, because he sort of said, "Well, it's a tough sport. You've got to take your medicine," and he wasn't going to kick up a fuss on the day, but certainly subsequently he's expressed displeasure in no uncertain terms. And I don't blame him for being upset, but I'm not sure who he can lash out at with much justification, given the rules under which the horses were playing. You can say, as I said, you can say the rules are rubbish if you want. That's perfectly valid. But I don't think there was a misapplication of them. And I don't think, even if you did get it to the courts, I don't think the courts would back it up. Courts hate turning around rulings from sporting bodies anyway. They don't really like doing it unless they feel that there's been an egregious error in the application of the rules. And there wasn't an egregious error in the application of the rules, even if the rules, as I said, aren't to everybody's satisfaction. And clearly, when he was talking about Ben talking about whether it was actually Gaffleone on War of Will who'd ridden irresponsibly to cause the incident, well, Mark Cassidy, I think, was quite right to jump in there and defend his man. And I think Mark Cassidy's quotes are eminently sensible over the last couple of days. And now I think probably that, given that the hard luck story is not going to the Preakness, the sort of next hardest luck story is, and probably people will be rooting for him.
Well, it's ultimately just the most unsatisfying conclusion of, you know, what is the biggest lead up of the racing year for all of us. I mean, the interest and the effort that goes into preparing for this race is so deep and extensive that you come away just unsatisfied, Nick. I mean, I keep coming back to that word, these last 3 days in grappling with what transpired.
Yeah, it was certainly pretty bizarre leaving the track and sort of trying to sort of decompress from the whole thing. So I can only imagine how bizarre it must have felt if you were any of the connections involved, either the eventual winners or the eventual losers. I mean, the one thing I would say is that, and I took a little bit of heat on social media for this, but I thought Jason Service and Luis Saez were very, very good after the race. And obviously Saez has got some significant personal perspective to put on situations like this. And Jason Service was very happy to be interviewed by me not once but twice after the fact, which was, to be honest, more than above and beyond the call of duty and the circumstances. I think if I'd been in his position, I'd have walked away and said thanks very much, but no thanks. But you know, I think my experience of most of the horsemen in America is that people in adverse situations realize that they have a responsibility to the viewing public as much as they do when they're winning. It's one thing to be a good winner, but you've got to be a good loser as well. I thought he was. And as I say, I'd have forgiven him if he just walked away and said, "No, I'm done." But yeah, there wasn't much coercion required, no matter what anybody tried to say.
And I didn't realize why would you have who would criticize
not that you should be too responsive to. And I really am never try to be too responsive to strong views held on social media, and obviously when people are disappointed either that they've A, lost money, or B, with the outcome of a race, then the easiest people to take a pop at are the people who are communicating that information. But I think, you know, there's always if people are in a difficult situation and you're there doing a job and you're trying to elicit information from them in what is quite an awkward situation, I think there's certain people who think, well, you should leave them alone. But if I was sitting at home and that had happened, I would want to know, well, what does Jason Service and Louis Size think about this at the moment? So if you were in a position to be able to be the conduit for that, then, you know, they're grown men. They can decide whether they want to talk to you or not. If they do want to talk to you, then that's fine by me. If they said to me, look, Mick, not now, I'd rather not. You know, just wait till this is over. Then fine. You respect that and you do a piece to camera. But, you know, I think you have to do your job as best you can in the circumstances and communicate that information, because that's what people at home want to see, and not in a ghoulish way, but just in a, you know, there was a significant degree of confusion. You need to clear that confusion up.
Yeah, well done, as always, Nick, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it with you. I also will take the morning after opportunity to mention the retirement of Pat Smeulen.
Oh, Pat Smeulen, yeah. I mean, quite an extraordinary man in every regard. The latter and most difficult part of this story is that Pat has been suffering with pancreatic cancer, which was diagnosed last year. And I mean, I think everyone will know that pancreatic cancer is generally pretty bad news. And he has made, if not a full recovery, at least he's on top of this disease. And on top of it in a significant way, the like of which I've rarely heard. And it's been absolutely remarkable, the way that he's fought it, the treatment that he's had, the way that he's been able, with his sort of innate fitness and determination, to be able to deal with it. And I think that there was a little bit of him, certainly when I last spoke to him back in March, he was holidaying with his family in Dubai. I think there was a little bit of him that's the half thought maybe that a comeback might be on the cards. Now, on medical advice, that's proven to be not a good idea. And he announced his official retirement yesterday, which I don't think is going to have come as much of a surprise to anyone in the circumstances. But the one thing that struck me was, given the amazing story of his battle, and an extremely successful, in many respects, battle with cancer, it had almost been forgotten exactly how much he'd achieved in his career. You know, he'd won virtually every major classic in Ireland. He'd won the Derby. He'd won huge races around the world. He'd been Irish champion jockey 9 times in an era which included some of the greats, Mick Kinnan, Johnny Murta, Joseph O'Brien. You know, he rode against some of the people would consider all-time European greats and beat them a lot of the time. You know, he wasn't far short of that himself, but he was never really one to thrust himself into the limelight too much. And just a proper gent, the professional's professional. And I think people are thinking it's very sad that he's had to announce his retirement, but we're very glad that he's still with us.
Absolutely. And this morning in the TDN, a piece that he wrote with the news, and he came over. We saw him here, you know, many Breeders' Cups and, you know, some other high profile opportunities when he would chip over. And I appreciate, you know, the opportunity to, while it's fresh, you know, to acknowledge a great career. I mean, really a complete career.
Yeah, and without wishing to sound trite, when you talk about what he's been through, and when you talk about the amazing recovery that he's making, and his extraordinary toughness to get on top of what is pretty horrendous disease, you do sort of think to yourself, well, for all its massive importance, Saturday was still a horse race, and all the participants have walked away from it healthy and intact. So that kind of is the main thing.
Very much so. Very much. Well, Nick, as always, greatly appreciate the opportunity to visit. When are we seeing you here again with more of the NBC coverage?
I'm really sorry to say that, yeah, you're going to be inflicted with me for the Preakness and the Belmont Stakes.
Oh, excellent. All right. I didn't realize.
Oh, and
all right,
Royal Ascot. And Royal Ascot, of course. So,
well, of course. Of course. Of course. That we'll wait for that. But, good. So we'll see you Saturday and Thursday, Friday, and leading up.
We'll catch up in Pimlico.
Outstanding. Nick Luck, everybody. And, his take, and he was right in the middle of I'll put up that picture probably with today's listing. It just a pretty amazing photograph, and you can see the the confusion and the whole the whole atmosphere. So good chance to get it firsthand from Nick. Let's take a break, a little past the top of the hour, and Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hillandale with Sid Fernando, and we'll get Sid's take on everything that transpired, then Tim Layden, and much, much more. Back after this.